Welcome to the Meisner Tierney Bizcast, a law podcast designed to provide information regarding corporate, litigation, tax, real estate, and other business matters. Meisner Tierney Fisher & Nichols attorneys produce these materials on a regular basis, covering topics that are current and relevant to owners, professionals, and others in the business community. Although we obviously can't provide legal advice that you can rely on in these presentations, we do hope that they will be helpful if and when you ever do need professional advice.
Hello and welcome back to the MTFN Bizcast. My name is James Cisnoski and I'm here again with Caleb Gerbitz, who is another attorney here at Meisner Tierney. And we're going to talk about the upcoming civil cases that are going to be argued in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court in November. We've got three of them, and two of those three involve statutory interpretation questions, which should be pretty interesting. So, Caleb, why don't you lead off and tell us about the Benuelos versus University of Wisconsin Hospitals case?
Absolutely. So this is almost a perfect statutory interpretation question. I think you were saying before we started that this would make for a great statutory interpretation exam question for a class. So what we have is the case is Benuelos v. University of Wisconsin Hospitals and Clinics Authority. It's being heard on November 1st. And what this case deals with is a statute pertaining to patient health care records. Wisconsin statute section 146.83 sub 3F sub B.
I'm sure everyone's going to remember that citation.
Yes, for the quiz later. So the statute creates a cap on the fees that healthcare companies can charge for providing patient healthcare records. And it says, you know, for paper copies, you can charge this much per page. I think it's a dollar per page for the first 25 pages, then it goes down for each page after that. Then there's another charge for microfiche or x-rays. There is not a listing for electronic copies.
And let me guess, this case is about the electronic copies.
Yes, exactly. So the plaintiff in this case, Benuelos, requested an electronic copy and the healthcare provider provided an electronic copy and then charged the rate for paper copies. And now this lawsuit says you can't charge me anything for electronic copies because the statute doesn't authorize that.
It doesn't explicitly authorize it, right? It doesn't mention it at all.
Right. And so that's the question. What do you do with that silence? Do you take that silence and say these fees aren't allowed at all? I think one of the counterarguments is by not referencing the statute that the state got out of the business of regulating electronic copies.
Yeah. And so you mentioned at the beginning that this is sort of the perfect statutory interpretation case. What did you mean by that?
As you go through the briefing, as you go through the Court of Appeals opinion, you run into all the different indicators of statutory meaning. You see the text itself, the context around the statute, closely related statutes. There's some statutory history going on, and there's a little bit of legislative history going on.
Can you briefly talk about what the difference is between statutory versus legislative history?
Oh, absolutely. This is a great distinction. So statutory history is what the legislature does with text and looking at what the legislature does with text. So if you have a statute that was amended 10 years ago, and let's say it said person A may do X and Y, and they amended it to say person A may do X, Y, or Z, that is the statutory history. You're comparing what the text was to what the text is now. Legislative history looks at what was going on in the historical context of that statutory change. So it looks at things like, what did legislators say when they were making this change? What did the drafters, what were like emails between the drafters about why they were making the change, legislative notes, all that other stuff that doesn't make it into the text is still generated by the amendment.
It's all that all the stuff that you can look at that's around the legislative process surrounding the statute being adopted, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And in this case, all of those things are at play here. You've got the text of the statute.
One more thing on statutory versus legislative history before we get into that.
Okay.
It's important to note that the court views those two things very differently in terms of persuasive authority. So statutory history, and there are a number of cases that say this is part of a plain meaning analysis. They'll always look at statutory history if it's presented. But legislative history is not part of the plain meaning. It's extra textual. So that's like a last resort.
Well, sort of.
All right.
The legislative history can come into play to confirm a plain meaning analysis. And so what you'll see in a lot of statutory interpretation cases is they'll go through the plain meaning analysis, and then there'll be an, oh, by the way, here's the legislative history that also agrees with us.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So, sort of.
Yeah.
So you want to talk a little bit about the pieces of, you talked a little bit about the text and the context and related statutes that are all going to come into play, but there's two significant pieces of both statutory and legislative history here, right?
Right. In 2009, the legislature via the budget, they added a provision saying that healthcare providers could charge a fee for electronic copies. And I think it was like a $9 fee or $5 fee, something like that. The governor, Governor Doyle at the time, he used his line item veto authority to strike out the dollar value on that fee as part of his veto message. And this is the legislative history. As part of his veto message, he said, "I'm vetoing this because I want to encourage healthcare providers to use electronic records. So I'm letting them decide what fee they're going to charge." Now, the statutory history, 2 years later in 2011, again in the budget, I believe, the legislature completely eliminated this provision about fees for electronic copies going to complete silence. And the question is, all right, how do you understand that change in that statutory history, that elimination of the text? And there were some other changes they made at the time. So the Court of Appeals spends a lot of time on how to interpret what the legislature has done or did in 2009 and 2011 and how that impacts how we interpret the statute now.
And Caleb, isn't the statute allowing healthcare providers to charge fees? Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't it phrased more in terms of a healthcare providers may only charge the fees?
Yes, it says, so the healthcare provider shall provide the copies. And then it says a healthcare provider may charge no more than the total of all of the following that apply. And that was a quote from the statute. So the argument that Benuelos makes here is no more than the total of all the following that apply. If one of the following is not electronic copies, you can't charge for electronic copies.
Gotcha. So, Caleb, what do you expect to see in this decision?
I expect to see the court say, you know, we look at the text of the statute and the text is plain and it says whatever the answer that they reach is. And then to draw on the related statutes and the statutory history to support that conclusion. And then maybe we'll even see, and oh, by the way, the legislative history supports this conclusion. But I suspect it'll kind of be a pull in all of these interpretive techniques to make an argument that majority of the court can sign on to.
I guess we'll see. So, Caleb, let's move on and talk a little bit about the next case, DEC Property Development versus DOT. What's going on here?
So DEC Property is the other case being heard on November 1st, and it also involves a question of legal interpretation, but we're moving away from statutory interpretation and into contract interpretation.
It's a text of a deed, right?
Yes, an indenture technically, which the Court of Appeals understood to be basically the same thing. And we're also dealing with an eminent domain argument here, so it's a pretty fascinating case. So back in 1961 in Kenosha County, there's this property that sits on the corner of a state trunk highway and a county highway, and it has driveways going to both the state trunk highway and the county highway. And an agreement was reached in 1961 to sell a portion of the property to the county as part of a highway improvement project. As part of that contract, there was a restricted driveway or right of access, depending on how you look at it, reserved in the contract for this property. And I'm just going to read it here because we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about it, so it helps to have the whole text. Except there is reserved the right of access to said highway by means of one restricted driveway, same to be used only for barbershop purposes for a term of 15 years from the date of this conveyance, and then to become a private driveway conforming to the regulations of the State Highway Commission.
And the question here is really, what does that mean?
That's a big part of what's going on here, yeah. So now, within the last couple of years, there's another construction project on the State Trunk Highway, and DOT came in and said, we're closing the driveway to the State Trunk Highway. However, no compensation was awarded, and DEC Property commenced a right-to-take action, saying, you can't take away my driveway without compensating me. The DOT is now saying, we didn't take away any property of yours. We simply condemned a driveway as we have the right to do.
And maybe briefly explain why the DOT can just come along and tell you can't have a driveway anymore.
Sure. So there's a distinction in the law. So when it comes to government actions as it relates to private property, Wisconsin courts talk about this distinction between an agency exercising its police power and exercising its eminent domain power. I don't know how well this distinction works, but Wisconsin courts use it all the time. So they say, police power is when the government is simply regulating someone's property. We're regulating what you can do on your property, how you can use your property. The government's not actually taking the property away. They're just restricting how it's used.
And even if that restriction lowers your property value, that doesn't constitute a taking. It doesn't trigger the requirement that government compensate you, right?
Right. Suppose you were using your property to grow marijuana, and the government said you can't grow marijuana anywhere, including on private property. That would be an exercise of police power, and you would be prohibited from growing marijuana on your property. And I imagine all this is true in the current state of Wisconsin law. It doesn't matter that you were only using your property for that purpose before. That purpose is illegal, and the government did not take your property by making it illegal.
Yeah, and if I'm remembering correctly here, what the DOT did is there's regulations that allow the DOT to set the number of driveways that you can have along a trunk highway, and they can actually set that number of driveways to zero, provided they don't cut off all access, right?
Right, and there's some argument, there's an administrative code section that the Court of Appeals relies on a bit that allows DOT to set the number of driveways. I believe DEC Property Development disputes whether that administrative code is relevant because it deals with granting of permits. But yeah, as a general matter, DOT can restrict where driveways go, how many driveways like a residential property has. It's not an uncommon use of the agency's power.
Yeah, and so getting back to the language of the deed here, the question that the Court of Appeals is addressing and that the Supreme Court's going to address is, what exactly did that indenture or the deed back in 1961 do? Did it reserve some kind of an easement on the part of the property owner to continue to have a driveway accessing the State Trunk Highway, or does that language subject to, the DOT's regulations, or at that point, the predecessor of the DOT's regulations, does that just mean that the DOT can take it away whenever and there's no real property interest?
Right. So this is the flip side of the police power, eminent domain power question. A court might conclude that you have a property interest in some part of your property, such as a right of access. So here you're talking about potentially an easement or an actual right of access to the highway, like a property interest. And if there's a property interest involved, then it's a taking. Government's taking away your property, and there has to be compensation. So as you said, basically that's the argument that's the dispute here, is taking away this driveway the government simply using its regulatory power, or is it actually taking away property? And yeah, you're right. That comes down to, what did this 1961 agreement say?
Yeah. And reading the Court of Appeals decision, it was, it seemed like what the conclusion was is that maybe there was, that there was never any easement at all that was reserved in that deed. It was simply, an agreement with the DOT to, for 15 years, have that driveway serving the barbershop. And then afterwards, it would just be a private driveway subject to DOT regulations. Those regulations apparently being that the DOT can come in at any time and say, you have no more driveway.
Yeah. And to be honest, I'm not quite sure how the Court of Appeals got there. You have something in the indenture saying that there's a right of access reserved.
Yeah, it sounds kind of like easement language almost.
Right. And now that you still have to contend with this language that this right of access, you know, lasts for the term of 15 years, then to become a private driveway. In 1961, I mean, the Court of Appeals kind of said all rights in the property were given away in 1961. Looking at this indenture, I think the counter argument is that there was a right of access that was reserved for at least 15 years following 1961. But the question is, what is left now,
yeah,
now that we're more than 15 years past that?
One final thought. Do you know whether there's been any amicus activity on this, any amicus briefs before the Court of Appeals, or any petition to file an amicus brief in the Supreme Court?
There hasn't been, which is a little bit surprising.
Yeah, it's an eminent domain issue. You'd expect, you know, someone to have an interest, even if it was like one of the municipal government associations.
Yeah, a lot of times these eminent domain cases draw a lot of attention, but it doesn't look like this one.
Yeah, well, I can't say that I have any solid thoughts about which direction the court's going to go, but it should be an interesting one to watch.
I agree. Well, James, should we move on to our last case of the month?
Sure. So the last case, and this one's going to be argued on the 7th, right?
Correct.
Is Secura Supreme Insurance Company versus the estate of Huck. Now, the facts of this are kind of sad. It involves a man who's working for a municipality when he was hit by a car, and he sadly passed away. And the tortfeasor, the individual who hit him, had $25,000 in insurance that was paid out to the man's estate. And
that's
then
not very much.
Yeah, it's not very much, which is going to eventually set up the issue. Because he was working for the municipality, the estate also received about $35,000 from the workers' compensation policy with the municipality. However, pursuant to state statute, the estate had to take some of the money it received from the tortfeasor's policy, that $25,000, and had to refund about $9,700 of that to the workers' comp carrier, right? So that's the basic, you know, facts behind this. Now,
so real quick, the estate got money from the person that hit him.
Correct.
And they had to give about 10,000 of that to the workers' compensation insurer, which had already paid him money.
Correct. Okay. And so the issue here is the decedent had his own auto policy with underinsured motorist coverage for, with $250,000 limits. And underinsured motorist coverage, or UIM coverage, covers the gap when there's insufficient insurance coverage. Now, this, pursuant to state statute, this policy, Secura's policy, had a reducing clause in it, which means the UIM limits are reduced by the amount, the total amount of workers' compensation received by the estate.
So a reducing clause. So I remember when I was clerking, the first time I came across one of these, I had no idea what it was, and it took me about an hour to figure it out. Why do policies have reducing clauses?
To avoid stacking of coverage. So, you know, the purpose of underinsured motorist coverage is to cover the gap, right, between what insurance should be versus what actually is there. And so the reducing clause, which is allowed, explicitly allowed under Wisconsin law in the case of UIM coverage, it allows the UIM insurer to reduce its coverage limits by the total amount of workers' compensation received by the estate. And so really the issue is that $9,700 that was initially paid to the estate by the tortfeasor's policy and then had to get paid to the workers' compensation insurance. Now, Secura maintains that it can apply its reducing clause to reduce the overall limits by that $9,700. That's the issue here.
So the goal of a reducing clause is basically to eliminate the possibility of double recovery, right?
Correct.
They're saying this money that the insured got but then had to give back contributes, like the coverage has to be reduced by that amount?
Yes, yes. That's what the reducing clause does. Now, the question here is whether or not that $9,700 was actually paid to the estate. Do you have the statutory language for us here?
I do. So we're looking at Wisconsin statute section 632.32 sub 5 sub I sub 2. And that says a policy can provide that the limits under the policy for underinsured motorist coverage for bodily injury or death shall be reduced by any of the following that apply. Sub 2 there is amounts paid or payable under any workers' compensation law.
And that's the key language, right? Amounts paid or payable. And so what Secura is arguing here is that because the tortfeasor's insurance policy initially paid that $9,700, the reducing clause applies, even though that amount was subsequently paid back to the workers' compensation carrier.
Okay. So they're saying, looking at the statute, the reducing clause applies for amounts paid. And they're saying this $9,000 was paid, therefore they can reduce coverage by that much.
Correct.
Okay.
This isn't the first time that this statute has come up in case law. There's a previous case back in 2006 called Teschendorf. And Teschendorf, it dealt with a little bit different scenario, but you know, basically the nuts and bolts of it is it was a 7-0 decision, so the entire Supreme Court agreed the reducing clause wouldn't apply because the insured under the UIM policy never actually received the benefits of whatever amount was trying to be reduced. But the court split multiple different directions on why that was the case. You had a contingent of the court that concluded the statute was ambiguous, and so they went to this more like general purpose type analysis. And you had another contingent of the court that came to the conclusion that applying the statute literally would reach an absurd result. You know, because it's sort of contrary to the idea of underinsured or uninsured motorist coverage, which is very similar. You know, these things exist to cover the gap. And if you never actually receive the money as the insured, it doesn't make any sense to allow a reducing clause to apply, or at least not within the statutory scheme. So this is setting up a pretty interesting statutory interpretation case.
Real quick, if this Teschendorf decision is out there from 2006, why did the court take this?
Well, we can't know for sure, but you know, one of the reasons they could have taken it was to clarify why the statute operates this way. I'd be a little surprised if the court was going to reverse Teschendorf because
it was a unanimous decision.
Yeah,
right?
It was unanimous, and then its underlying facts don't always come into it. But here you have someone who has purchased underinsured motorist coverage, and you know, who's killed, was paid, but then had to pay right back out an amount. And you know, I don't think the court is going to endorse the idea that, you know, just because you had the money for a short period of time, that now your UIM limits are going to be reduced based on it. So I would be surprised if they reversed it. I think it's probably more in the line of them, the court, you know, clarifying why the statute reads this way. And it also presents a lot of the, you know, basic statutory interpretation principles here, including, I would say, interpreting, you know, the context and the closely related statutes. Here, the closely related statutes being, you know, kind of the whole UIM and UM insurance regulations. Which when you look at those, the, you know, Secura's reading of the statute that, you know, well, technically you got paid, so even though you had to give it back, I don't know that reading makes a lot of sense. But even more than that, I'm not entirely sure that you can say that, you know, getting back to the statutory language, that an amount was paid or payable if you immediately had to pay it from your, you know, from one
insurer. Give it back. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well,
and it doesn't feel like you got paid at that point.
In Secura's defense here, making the argument that they're making, it was received from one source and then paid back to another source as sort of as a reimbursement. And there was actually a concurrence in this case by Judge Grogan that essentially pointed that out.
Before the Court of Appeals?
Yeah, before the Court of Appeals. So Judge Grogan pointed out that there was, you know, Teschendorf was binding and kind of resolved the case. But, you know, given that there were some slight factual differences between Teschendorf and this case, that Sakura's argument, had they been writing on a blank slate with no precedent, would have been a closer call. Now, that was a very interesting concurrence because Judge Grogan didn't imply or even suggest that Teschendorf was incorrect, merely that it would have been a closer case. I don't know if this is just giving some credit to Sakura's counsel for, you know, making what is, it's a textually plausible argument, right? You look at the text and it's like, well, technically, you know, he was paid, but, you know, if you want to read it a little bit, I think more reasonably and more in context with the statutes, I still don't think that's the best reading.
It strikes me as the type of case where, and Justice Scalia used to use this terminology a lot. He said he was not a strict constructionist. He read statutes reasonably. And I think this statutory language kind of gives you an opportunity to, you can read it strictly one way, you can read it reasonably another way. And I agree, Judge Grogan's concurrence kind of focuses in on that a little bit.
Yeah, and I think one other thing that's kind of notable here is, you know, why is this case over $9,700 going to the Supreme Court?
That's a good question, James. Why is it?
Well, I think you have to look at this from the standpoint of the insurer, Sakura. Sakura is not just probably thinking about this one case and the $9,700. They're trying to set a precedent for UAM coverage across the state. You know, I don't know what kind of policies they may or may not issue in this state, but insurers generally have an interest in, you know, making favorable law. And that's really, you know, why that's going, I think, from their standpoint. But as far as why the Supreme Court took the case, which is a different question, I think there's just room to clarify the statutory analysis, given the fact that Teschendorf went a bunch of different ways and there was no majority. There was no majority opinion, right? Even though it was a 7-0.
Teschendorf, right. Yeah, it's fractured.
Yeah, so there's at least some room to clarify the law in that respect. So it is a good candidate for them to reach it. But I'd be surprised if they're going to reverse Teschendorf.
All right, so we've got three cases that we went over, and I don't know, maybe three affirmances? Do we not make predictions on this show?
Well, maybe we should start. I've made my prediction for Sakura being an affirm. What do you think about DEC?
I think it's an affirm on different reasoning.
An affirm on different reasoning. Okay, well, we'll probably revisit that. And I don't know what your thoughts are on Ben Wallace, but I think that's probably going to be an affirm as well. And watch. We're going to be completely wrong when these come out.
Always unpredictable.
Well, thank you for tuning in to our to the MTFN BizCast, and we hope to see you next time for the preview of December's cases. And I'd like to give a special note of thanks to Pamela Zacharias and Kylie Martins for working together on this podcast and helping get it off the ground. It's certainly been a lot of fun. They've been a big help.
Wouldn't have been able to do without them.
Absolutely. So we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to this Meisner Tierney BizCast. We hope this information will be helpful to you. For more information, please visit our website, mtfn.com. There you can access this and other podcasts, as well as other useful information. If this has been helpful, please feel free to subscribe, leave a review, or provide other input.